Well, it's a great honor to be here. This is my favorite place for giving a talk or a speech or whatever. It's a rare honor, and I really appreciate it. And I hope I can live up to the wonderful words of Reverend David. I'm here because our country especially is facing a crisis right now. And it's a crisis that also involves directly and indirectly fathers. Because we fathers, our first duty usually, traditionally at least, is to sort of protect the home and the family and the country and all these things. And there's a lot of difficulty and sadness in our world right now. Depression is at an all-time high in America. And we thought we found the magic bullet, which was antidepressant pills. And they don't work. They're very dangerous. So right now, we're of course very sad for all the killing in America, which also goes back to our roots and our culture. And a lot of people die from guns, even most of them by suicide. Even more people die from automobile accidents. But the leading cause of death now in the last 2 years has doubled or tripled in the last 5 years. And that's death because of opioids, painkillers, antidepressants, and of course cocaine and heroin and all the rest of them. But the thing is, we have medicated our society to such an extent, sometimes we have as many as 30 or 40%, for example, of middle-class, middle-aged white women on antidepressants. It's a huge number. Some of them are doing 2 or 3 antidepressants or painkillers. It's not healthy. And this proliferation of drugs means the kids get it and bad things happen. I'm also here because it hit me at home last year. I advise a fraternity at Sonoma State University. One of the brightest young men chatted with me a bit about his joy at being his part-time job of being a cameraman for the 49er football team. Just loved it. He was very happy he was going to graduate. He had a wonderful girlfriend. He got a great career all lined up. Then I got a call in the middle of the night saying something went wrong. He had been celebrating with his friends. 3 a.m. in the morning, they found him face down in the hallway next to his bedroom. And he had died from binge drinking and opioids. Some kind of painkiller he was getting high on. And the sad thing was, I found out during the funeral arrangements that he wasn't on good terms with his father. His father had left after the divorce. And he had no brothers or sisters, so the fraternity was really important to him. And then I realized that I was sort of the father figure to that fraternity, and it was very hard on me. We spent a year on probation. During that time, the university investigated, and we did our own interviews, and we found out that 35% of the students were not just binge drinking, but they were also using either marijuana or other drugs. Easily 35%. Probably 50%, because a lot of them dropped out when they knew we were going to be asking and testing. So it's a very critical issue right now, which fortunately most of us aren't aware of unless it hits our families or our friends. On the other hand, there are answers out there for depression, for sadness, for brain atrophy, in other words, dementia, Alzheimer's. We now know how to preserve and enhance our brain power. We know how to get better brain longevity thanks to a lot of modern science, especially the magnetic resonant imaging, MRIs. They can take a video of your brain while you're thinking different things. They can see the effect of your thoughts and your emotions. So a couple of scientists, actually many of them at the University of Pennsylvania, studied all these thousands of different research studies and experiments around the world, They came up with 8 ways that we can improve our brains, make them healthier, make ourselves happier, give ourselves general health as well. Because everything goes to the brain. You know, in unity, we are spiritual beings having a human or earthly experience. The only way that spiritual being gets through to us is through our brain. Our brain's our computer. It's our translator. It's our everything. It's our memory bank. Now, we can have a consciousness without the brain. We know that from near-death experiences and from 36,000 studies of reincarnation on a scientific basis. So the mind is much bigger than the brain. But the brain is our best tool, and it's an amazing tool. Our brain has 20 billion neurons, and they all connect with thousands, if not millions, of other neurons. That's how we think. Each little neuron sends out a thread, and this thread becomes a connection to another one they call a synapse. And the more synapses you have, the better you think. And as you kill your synapses with negative activities, you lose brain power. So these 8 techniques I thought were kind of fun and interesting, and spirituality can be fun because now science is really verifying in very fascinating ways all the things that the ancient religions taught about how to live your life. It's kind of fun to say, hey, science is discovering this. Well, it's giving us much more credibility and understanding and day-to-day techniques that I think will help us. So here's the 8 in descending order. I'm starting with number 8 on the list. We'll work our way up to the most important. But number 8 is kind of fun because it's something you can do very easily. I see a lot of it around unity. You can smile. All right, that's technique number 8. Smiling spreads happiness, but it also triggers the right neurotransmitters in your brain that trigger chemicals going through your blood and help you get healthy. So smiling, liking people, loving people, doing favors for people is great. They did an experiment, and they gave half of the patients a little bag of jelly beans. They said, when you go into your doctor for your diagnosis, and these were people with very serious diagnoses that couldn't be figured out, they said, give your doctor these jelly beans as your bit of appreciation. The doctors who got the jelly beans were 20% more accurate on their diagnoses. And that's a big jump. That saved a lot of lives. So if you're going to the doctor and they have to figure out what's wrong with you, bring him some jelly beans. Or tell him you appreciate what he's doing. Doctors don't always get appreciated. Number 7 on the list is something you probably all know about. You've heard it on the radio. They're advertising for luminosity. I hear it all the time. You exercise your brain. You do thinking puzzles and things, and it helps your brain to do well. Well, actually, they haven't had any long-term studies of things like luminosity. And they are a little skeptical that it helps long term. But they do know that when you think big ideas and challenging thought problems, it helps your brain. It exercises, it builds new neuron connections, new synapses. And you will get a much denser neural it's kind of like a texture to your frontal lobes, which just means you have better reasoning powers. Now, you can also do games. They find that playing chess helps people who are very old and starting with dementia. And they can reverse a lot of dementia just by playing chess, because it's challenging. You can also do video games. My grandkid was happy to hear this. But then I said, but okay, only certain video games, because the negative ones, the ones with violence or good and evil, those don't work. Those hurt your brain. Those really hurt your outlook on life. So we want to avoid the negative, and that's going to be a theme throughout here. Number 6, relax. And that doesn't mean be a couch potato, but relax by consciously thinking about your muscles and your posture, and let your body go, okay? And sometimes you have different techniques. You can shake your shoulders. Deep breaths help. Relaxing you might think, makes you less alert. But actually, it makes you more alert. When you're relaxed, you're more tuned in to your environment. You're a safer person. Whether you're driving or whether you're giving a talk or whatever, if you can relax, all the better. And gentle music can help. Rituals can help. Just watching a ritual, like at some churches, we have a little bit of ritual here, can help you. And doing things like knitting that's repetitive, or a mantra, it helps your brain to kind of feel comfortable and safe, okay? And stop ruminating and worrying, which you never want to do, okay? So that's number six. Number five, kind of related to that, a good way to relax and become alert and aware is to use your mouth, not with a smile. Well, smiles are good, but there's another way, and they've all heard it, so they can't tell you. And it's not singing, which would be great. And it might be singing, but we haven't proven that yet. This one is well proven, and it goes back hundreds of years. Yawning. Would you have guessed that yawning helps your brain? Yawning makes you smarter, more alert. And maybe it's because when you're sleepy, you yawn because your body wants to wake up a little bit. In the process of yawning, you stretch some muscles, you breathe a little deeper maybe. Whatever it is, it triggers the brain to release really good stuff. And when they test students by telling them to yawn 5 times before they take the test, they do much better on the test. Double-blind study, very reliable. And they actually have 36 different studies of the benefits of yawning. 36 around the country and the world. And they all show that it helps your brain. So yawn. I'm not offended. I know you're not bored. But if you yawn a little bit, it will help you to stay tuned in. A little bit counterintuitive. Now, when you're yawning and you're relaxed, what do you do next? You probably all know this. And the Tibetan Buddhists are famous for it. It's meditating. And that beautiful meditation that Reverend David led us on. Even the guided meditation part is good, but the silent meditation is the most helpful. Deep control of your mind, your brain, really. It's your mind controlling your brain. Your mind is the real you. And you have to control those emotions. And you get the strength to do that from meditating, okay? Especially when you just meditate to clear your mind, because you're then saying, thinking part of me, stop. Let me get to the deeper, more spiritual part of myself. So they can see the Tibetan lamas have different brain structures. And when they give classes in meditation to people, after 5 weeks, they start to have different brain structures already. And they can see the change in brain waves, which is significant. So meditation's great, and it triggers anti-stress hormones. So for people who are stressed, doctors now are telling you, try meditation. And prayer is about the same. Prayer also has the positive vibe, usually of praying for the good of others, which helps you too. So that's why we heart ministers really have a great privilege of being able to pray with people, you know, and to try to put it on a higher level. The third one, you probably all know, because it's general health. They tell you to do it if you want to stay healthy, but it's also good for the brain. It's like good nutrition and, in this case, exercise. Now, actually, to help the brain, any exercise helps your body, but to help the brain, you need aerobic exercise, deep breathing exercise. So bicycling, maybe, running, swimming, tennis, walking up a hill quickly. If you can get yourself breathing a little harder, that's going to help your brain, more oxygen. Number two, this is the important one. These are the last two. Dialogue, talking, and talking with someone you care about on a deep level. It can be one-on-one, it can be a group, it can be like this. But talking stimulates the brain. When you do it and when you key into someone else, The other thing is, of course, that talking is wonderful for your life, because this is what makes us human. This is how we cooperate. We exchange information and feelings. That's where it really gets important. If you can get down to exchanging your feelings, that's the real you. You know, all the logic and all the memories and stuff, that's your computer brain. The feelings are your real self, your real heart. So I gave you a handout. If you didn't pick it up, it's okay. There's more out there, probably. Meaningful dialogues. And we'll get to it in a minute, come back to it. But I want to give you first the final top way of helping your brain. And I don't think most of you would guess it. You can be thinking in your own mind, what else is left out here? A few things are left out because science can't validate them yet, like sleep, exactly how it affects the brain. They know it affects the brain greatly, but and diet is too complicated for sure for scientific certitude. But this one is very clear, and it's number one. This is from psychiatrists, not ministers. Number one is faith, spirituality, and not just going to church, not just religion, because some religions are actually sort of negative. The idea of an authoritarian, cruel, punishing God actually depresses a lot of people. And when they put you on the MRI, they can see it doing bad things to your brain. We're fortunate that we have a much more uplifting, loving idea of spirit and God in this church. So faith, and it doesn't have to be a religious faith. Atheists and agnostics can have faith. You might remember great writer about the Jewish Holocaust observed that... Thank you, Viktor Frankl. He noticed, and he did a study more or less, I think it's more than anecdotal, of how people came out of the Holocaust after being scared to death and losing many of their relatives and being starved in many cases, or even tortured in a sense. Some people flourished and some people really couldn't cope with it. He said the only thing he could see that made a difference was their faith. He said even the Jews who lost faith in their image of God, in their protective sort of more anthropomorphic God, if they had a faith in humanity or in history or in their Jewish culture or in their own abilities, that faith, that ability to get over their doubts and to believe something strongly, was very, very supportive of their future life and flourishing. So we should all be grateful that we're here and we get to share our faith a little bit. I want to go back to dialogue. It's one way we share our faith too. And I have this handout because these scientists basically have found a dozen ways of helping and improving your communication and your dialogue. And we all know that communication is pretty much the key to relationships. And you'll see that a lot of these reflect the same things that help your brain, because they're trying to get you in a mindset that is positive and loving and caring about the other person. And they give you ways to stay in that place, like speaking briefly, listen deeply, speaking warmly and slowly, reflecting on your deepest values. These things are all good for your brain too and your body. So it even has yawning at the very first and relaxing. So you can see how they are very coordinated. What's good for the brain is good for the communication. And number 11, the hardest thing of all, listen to negativity without reaction or judgment. Reframe it into something positive. We learn how to do that a little bit in nonviolent communication, but it's very, very hard. I have trouble with it myself. I've been working on it for 20 years. So we're not going to all become experts at this, but I do want to give you one example of how this can work. And it relates to somebody who is not my biological father, although I have a wonderful real father, but He was my father figure in college when I was the same age as Francis, who died of the drug overdose. I went to work for Beacon's Moving and Storage because it was good money, and I was a young athlete, and I liked moving furniture all day long. And I really did love it. And my partner, I was amazed. He was such a craftsman. He could load that truck so perfectly, get everything in there, that for the whole summer, we didn't have any damage claims at all. Most drivers would have 20 or 30 in a summertime. You know, things break. Things get scratched. Occasionally they got scratched, but Bill was such a diplomat and so nice to people, such a good heart. They said, just okay, we don't care. We're not going to file a claim against you. And I realized that Bill had suffered a lot and learned how to be very kind. He came from Oklahoma as an African-American to California, couldn't find a job, became a drunk, a severe alcoholic, homeless for a while. He got a job with Cherry's Moving and Storage in Alameda, 1958 or so, all black moving company because they were all segregated. There was no law of equal employment then, no Civil Rights Act. He only had 2 or 3 days of work each week from that company. They were struggling. It was a tiny company. So he went to Beacon's Moving and Storage, the biggest moving company in the world. They had 50 drivers and trucks in Oakland. And he said, can I work for you? No, we don't hire blacks. Are you crazy? Go back to Cherry's. No, I really want to work for you guys. I'll be here. I'll help out. Whatever you want. I'll sweep the floors. No. He went there every day for like 3 months. Not every day, but several days a week. Finally, they had an emergency. Somebody didn't show up. They were sick. Gosh, we really got to do this job. We got an out-of-town truck here. You want to work for a few hours? Okay, he worked for a few hours. 3 weeks later, he got another job like that. After 3 years of part-time work there, they hired him. And during that time, and even after they hired him, most of these Teamster truck drivers were real racists. I mean, rednecks, the worst. They cussed him out. They slashed his tires. They spit on him. He never replied in kind. He took their abuse. And my second summer of working with Bill, they had an election for the union steward, the top guy for all the union workers. And even though by then they had integrated Beacons, thanks to Bill, and there were about 10 or 15% African Americans, the surprising thing was that all those white workers and truck drivers voted for Bill almost unanimously to become the union steward. It was an absolute miracle. 1964. That really amazed me. And a couple years later, I went to Alabama to work in the war on poverty. I thought a lot about Bill because he'd come out of poverty by himself, and he'd helped all these guys get good union jobs. And I called him up when I got back. I said, Bill, how you doing? You still got your job? Oh, yeah. Still steward? Oh, yeah. I'm really happy to be steward. And he said, guess what? Remember I adopted that little girl? I said, yeah, I remember. He says, well, I adopted two more. Wow. So he was 50 years old. He was starting a family because he had screwed up his early life. He raised those girls. And when I called him 15 years later, two of the girls were in high school. The oldest girl was already going to college. They were all getting great grades, doing wonderfully. You have to understand, Bill never even went to high school. So he did all this in his life because he turned around and somehow he found the inner strength. And he knew how to take this negativity and change it into something beautiful and positive. So that's why Bill, to me, was a wonderful father figure and a real hero. So thank you for letting me share that.